The U.S. sees the Pakistanis as a key player in the peace talks just because it has the most leverage over the Taliban.
We explore the perceived importance of Pakistan to the United States. It's Thursday, July 18th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, protests have left Hong Kong's police force with many problems. And Myanmar's top military leaders have been barred from the United States. It all comes your way on today's VOA Asia. Police in Pakistan have arrested an Islamist cleric whom the United States has designated as a global terrorist for his alleged role in the deadly 2008 attacks on the Indian city of Mumbai. Hafiz Saeed, the founder of the outlawed Lashkar-e-Taiba militant group and head of its banned charity wing, Jamaat-ud-Dawah, JUD, was traveling to Punjab province when he was taken into custody. A spokesman for the provincial counterterrorism department said Saeed was taken to a nearby anti-terrorism court where the judge ordered the cleric held in jail for a week. The court also directed authorities to complete investigations into money laundering and terrorism financing charges against the radical cleric so he could be put on trial. Pakistani authorities have recently initiated more than 20 cases against Saeed and several of his aides pertaining to the JUD's alleged involvement in money laundering and terrorism financing. The arrest also comes ahead of next week's visit to Washington by Prime Minister Imran Khan, where he's scheduled to hold his first meeting with U.S. President Donald Trump on July 22nd to discuss, among other things, Pakistani counterterrorism efforts. There is another major issue at stake here, according to Michael Kugelman, the deputy director and senior associate for South Asia at the Washington-based Wilson Center. I spoke with him about it.
The U.S. believes that Pakistan has been helpful to this point in the Afghan peace talks. The first thing that the Americans asked Pakistan to do was to actually bring the Taliban to the peace table or to the negotiating table. And so one of the first things Pakistan did was that it released a senior Taliban leader, Mullah Baradar, from a Pakistani prison so that he could come to the talks in the Gulf and participate in them. So the Americans have actually been relatively happy with the Pakistanis. And the latest thing that the U.S. is hoping that Pakistan will do is to try to convince the Taliban to agree to a ceasefire, which is something that the Taliban to this point has not really expressed any interest at all in doing. So bottom line, you know, the U.S. sees the Pakistanis as a key player in the peace talks just because it has the most leverage over the Taliban of any nation state. And that's because it's provided safe havens to the Taliban leadership in Pakistan. So it hopes that Pakistan could really play a facilitating and enabling role to get the Taliban to the table and to keep them at the table and to try to convince the Taliban to agree to the things that the U.S. is looking to get looking to get out of this peace process.
Which is rather interesting that the relationship between the United States and Pakistan moved to historic lows since Donald Trump took office in 2017, accusing Islamabad of harboring those militant groups that U.S. forces are fighting in Afghanistan.
You know, we had President Trump ring in the new year in 2018 by saying that the Pakistan takes the U.S. leaders for fools and that they're full of lies and deceit. And here we are. Here he is welcoming Imran Khan to the White House. Yeah, it certainly is a striking contrast to what had happened earlier. Though my own view is that we may overstate how different things had been some time ago. I mean, it's true that the Trump administration and Trump himself had said all kinds of nasty things about the Pakistanis. But I would not actually argue that the U.S. had actually taken a tough position toward Pakistan. I mean, the U.S. did suspend security assistance to Pakistan at the beginning of 2018. But other than that, aside from the nasty rhetoric and the bluster, the U.S. actually hasn't really cracked down on Pakistan. It hasn't taken any punitive measures against the Pakistanis other than the security assistance cutoff. So, I think that the U.S. knows that Pakistan is an important player in the context of Afghanistan. The U.S. knows that if Pakistan antagonizes Pakistan by engaging in steps that are viewed by Pakistan as too harsh, then the Pakistanis could, you know, stop cooperating with the United States and Afghanistan in the peace talks, which, as I've said before, are at a point where the Pakistanis are believed to be a helpful partner. So bottom line is the U.S. cannot afford to take that hard of a line on Pakistan because it doesn't want to antagonize Pakistan at a moment when it really wants to get a deal in Afghanistan. So we shouldn't think that the Trump administration had taken a tough position on Pakistan to start with, even though we had all this nasty rhetoric coming from the Trump administration and the president himself.
This is not the only issue between the two countries. This has not been the only issue. Another one is China.
Yeah, well, I mean, clearly, you know, the U.S. does see China's growing investment footprint in Pakistan with some concern and even alarm, given that the U.S. has identified China as its top strategic partner, as its top strategic rival. And the U.S. has also said that it regards strategic rivalry as a national security threat. And so that means that the U.S. essentially sees China as not only a strategic rival, but as a national security threat. So the last thing the U.S. wants is for its top strategic rival and a national security threat building out its influence and deepening its investment footprint in a country, Pakistan, that is very important to U.S. interest, even though the U.S. is increasingly absent, or at least not as present in Pakistan as the Chinese are, and certainly not as popular. And you know, it's true that as this CPEC project, this China-Pakistan Economic Corridor project, continues apace, you know, the U.S. is going to continue to be concerned as to what the broader implications are of this of these efforts in Pakistan on the part of China.
And one would imagine that this and other issues will be on the agenda as far as Imran Khan, the prime minister, paying his visit to Washington.
Well, you know, that's interesting. I think that, yes, and I imagine that it will come up in the meeting between Trump and Khan. Though I think that the actual conversation in this meeting, which I imagine will be fairly short, will probably revolve around only a few issues. I imagine that Imran Khan will come into the meeting wanting to discuss all types of things, from trade and investment cooperation to trying to convince Trump to restore the suspended security assistance to Pakistan. I think Trump is going to want to talk mainly about Afghanistan. I think he's going to want to get a deeper commitment from Imran Khan to really work together with the U.S. to take this cooperation to a different level and bringing the Taliban into a situation where there can be a peace deal. I imagine that Trump will want to talk about terrorism as well and try to impress upon Khan the view on the part of the U.S. government that Pakistan has not done enough to crack down on these terror groups on its soil that pose threats to not only U.S. troops in Afghanistan, but also India. So I think that, you know, the expectations will be divergent. The Pakistanis are going to want to bring a lot more to the table than the Americans will. The Pakistanis are really going to be ready to talk about resetting the relationship. But I don't think the U.S. wants to go there. It has a very narrow view of this relationship with Pakistan. It wants to get Pakistan to help it in Afghanistan. And until Pakistan helps the U.S. to an extent that satisfies U.S. needs, I don't really think the U.S. is going to want to talk about many other things.
Michael Kugelman spoke with us via Skype. He is Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Washington-based Wilson Center. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. The International Court of Justice Wednesday ordered Pakistan to review a death sentence it had handed down to an Indian national convicted of spying. A senior U.S. diplomat has been sent to help settle worsening tensions between South Korea and Japan. Protesters held an anti-Japan rally Wednesday in Seoul, mocking a man wearing a mask resembling Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. A 5.7 magnitude earthquake shook Bali Tuesday, causing panic and damaging buildings, but no immediate reports of casualties. Families of victims and their country's embassies are marking the fifth anniversary of the downing of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 over the conflict zone in eastern Ukraine. This is VOA Asia. Hong Kong's police force is facing a crisis of confidence and leadership amid the city's worsening political tensions, according to serving and retired officers, politicians, and security analysts. Reuters' Michelle Hennessy has more.
Hong Kong police once prided themselves as one of Asia's finest forces. But as the former British colony sinks deeper into chaos, the force is facing a fresh crisis of its own. Sources have told Reuters it's struggling to cope amid haphazard decision-making and worsening morale.
What we're hearing is that there is a great deal of concern among rank-and-file officers that they're not getting the political protection they deserve. So there's concern about leadership. There's concern that the government might throw them under the bus if things get much heavier on the streets. There's some senior former police officers who are still in touch with the force are telling us that they need far clearer guidelines on the use of tear gas and so on, perhaps to stop what we've seen to be increasing use of baton charges to clear small groups of protesters.
This was the scene outside the police HQ last month. Thousands rallied and blocked its entrances, angry at how the police were handling the protests. One member of the force told Reuters these recruitment posters that were once plastered around the building have now been torn down during the protests.
We're getting evidence that there is alarm both among the political elites, both pro-Beijing and democratic, and also the police themselves, that there is a breakdown in the relations with the public. I was out at Yau Tong on Friday night. They were putting posters up on the linen walls, and then there was some incident with a suspected policeman taking photographs, and suddenly there were lots of people and commuters even swearing and screaming at the police, calling them black dogs and far worse. And I just hadn't seen behaviour quite like that.
The marches have turned into almost daily demonstrations, and if the police struggle to maintain order, some sources tell Reuters Plan B might involve China.
There are some foreign security analysts that are starting to look more closely at the expanding role of the People's Armed Police, a paramilitary force on the mainland. It forms an anti-riot function in a mainland Chinese context, not a free Hong Kong context. They're a pretty robust force, and I don't think that would be acceptable, from what I understand, not just to the Hong Kong public, but also the Hong Kong police. It wouldn't be as provocative as using soldiers, but it would be one step in that direction.
A police statement to Reuters did not respond directly to questions about officers' concerns, but said violent protests seriously undermine the rule of law.
That was Reuters reporter Michelle Hennessy. Happening now in Asia, the International Monetary Fund said Wednesday the U.S. dollar was overvalued by 6 to 12% based on near-term economic fundamentals, while the euro, the Japanese yen, and China's yuan were seen as broadly in line with fundamentals. Remember to stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are happy you're with us. Tuesday, the United States announced sanctions on the Myanmar military's commander-in-chief, Min Aung Hlaing, and other military leaders it said were responsible for extrajudicial killings of Rohingya Muslims, barring them from entry to the United States.
Myanmar's army chief has been banned from the United States. That's part of new sanctions announced by the State Department on Tuesday, its toughest response yet on the Rohingya massacre. Along with Commander-in-Chief Min Aung Hlaing, several other military leaders have been barred from entering the U.S. The State Department says all of them were responsible in the killings of Rohingya Muslims. More than 730,000 Rohingya were driven out of Myanmar during a brutal military crackdown in 2017. UN investigators say the crackdown included mass killings, gang rapes, and widespread arson committed with genocidal intent. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo issued a statement on Tuesday's sanctions, saying, "We designated these individuals based on credible information of these commanders' involvement in gross violations of human rights." The military in Myanmar, where Buddhism is the main religion, has denied accusations of ethnic cleansing and says its actions were part of a fight against terrorism. The State Department has so far stopped short of calling the abuses genocide, but a declaration of genocide by the U.S. government could require Washington to pose even stronger sanctions on Myanmar. A U.N. investigator this month said Myanmar security forces and insurgents were committing human rights violations against civilians, which could amount to fresh war crimes.
That is Reuters' Grace Lee. Meanwhile, hundreds of people demonstrated in Myanmar's largest city of Yangon Wednesday. My colleague Steve Miller, the host of VOA's International Edition, spoke with VOA Burmese Service Chief Thun Win Tun.
Basically, it is about constitutional amendment. So the current constitution is drafted and approved in 2008. So everybody in Burma or also international consensus is that, two, that constitution is very unfair and need a lot of amendments. Some even suggest that scrap the constitution. So yesterday there was a kind of proposal to have the kind, a lot of points in to make amendment in the current constitutions. So one set of protests is actually to support the change or to amend the constitution. But there's another set of protests which is against, particularly about clause number 59 or something like that, which is make a kind of restrictions about presidential candidates.
Right, because right now Aung San Suu Kyi is prohibited to being the actual president of Myanmar, also known as Burma, and they want to change that, even though she's the de facto head of state.
Yeah, yeah. That's a particular constitutional clause barred her from taking the official office as a president because of her husband and her sons are foreign nationals.
Is there any indication as to why this is taking place now? Because as we've been discussing, the Constitution dates back to 2008. This is 2019.
Yeah, it's one of the campaign promises by the current National League for Democracy ruling party is to change the Constitution or to amend the Constitution. So, but the nature of that 2008 Constitution is very rigid. Very difficult to change, especially for the very important or controversial clauses.
Because the military maintains 25% control of the government and you need more than 75% to pass any constitutional amendments, what's next?
Yeah, it is a long process. You know, that for the moment, the Joint Committee for the Constitutional Amendment reported back to the parliament. They collected altogether 3,765 points to make as an amendment points. So proposal. I don't know I don't know how it will be discussed and how it will be approved. For example, even for the one clause, there's a different proposal from 14 political parties and individual. So some ethnic nationality groups want such change in their way. Some political party don't want it and they're different. So I don't know how they will accept the proposal or reject the proposal. So it is very, very vague anyway. So, of course, we will be watching this situation as a kind of movement which will be manipulated by the both sides before the 2020 elections.
VOA Burmese Service Chief Thun Win Tun. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news now from VOA Asia. India will identify and deport illegal immigrants from across their country, the Interior Ministry said Wednesday, stepping up a campaign that critics say could stoke religious tension and further alienate minority Muslims. Visit VOA Asia Facebook every day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. Foreign ministers from 100 countries joined survivors of massacres at churches, mosques, and synagogues to call for tolerance and respect for religious freedom and religious pluralism around the world Tuesday. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Sidi Sain has more from the State Department.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and U.S. Ambassador for Religious Freedom Sam Brownback said this Religious Freedom Summit is intended to get people of different faiths to come together in the face of religious persecution and deadly attacks on places of worship.
All people from every place on the globe must be permitted to practice their faith openly in their homes, in their places of worship, in the public square, and believe what they want to believe.
Survivors of recent religious persecution and attacks provided powerful testimony, including Nadia Murad, a Yazidi and former Islamic State group captive from northern Iraq.
History and research have taught us time and time again that genocide is an ongoing process. Nearly 350,000 Yazidis are still stranded in IDP camps in Kurdistan. Over 3,000 Yazidi women and children remain missing. In 2014, the international community rallied behind the Yazidi cause. Today, the Yazidi have largely been abandoned.
Yamini Ravi Dran survived this year's Easter Sunday shootings at Christian churches in Sri Lanka.
The impact it has had on our community, in particularly the Christian community, it has left us with a fear psychosis like never before.
Farid Ahmed survived the shooting at a mosque in Christchurch, New Zealand, but his wife was killed as she tried to push his wheelchair to the exit. He said his faith taught him to forgive the killer. The
Quran has taught me that if anyone does bad stuff to you, in return do good. اِدْفَعْ بِالَّتِي هِيَ أَحْسَنُ. If anyone does evil to you, do the opposite. So he gave me hatred, and I gave him love.
The survivors said the tragedies have helped people of different faiths unite against bigotry and hatred. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
This news break from VOA Asia. Vietnamese and Chinese ships have been embroiled in a weeks-long standoff near an offshore oil block in disputed waters of the South China Sea, which fall within Vietnam's exclusive economic zone, two Washington-based think tanks said on Wednesday. China's U-shaped 9-dash line marks a vast expanse of the South China Sea that it claims include large swaths of Vietnam's continental shelf where it has awarded oil concessions.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers at the California Institute of Technology have discovered a near-Earth orbiting asteroid with the shortest year known for any asteroid in the solar system. Called 2019 LF6, this nearly 1 kilometer-wide rocky asteroid circles the sun in an elliptical orbit over a 151-day period. The asteroid's orbit takes it from beyond Venus to closer to the sun than Mercury. 2019 LF6 is known as an Altera asteroid, which are about 20 asteroids whose orbits are contained within Earth's orbit of the Sun. Though the 2019 LF6 is considered a near-Earth object, astronomers have determined that it is not considered potentially hazardous. The Caltech astronomers made their discovery with the Zwicky Transient Facility, a camera that was recently installed on a telescope at the Palomar Observatory near San Diego, California. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Remember to get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud, download our podcast, and take VOA Asia with you. Our thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Nelson Lopes, the managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.